This webinar is dense packed for insulation and air sealing of California homes. We're thrilled to offer this, the part two of a webinar that started on Monday. This is part of the 1000 Home Challenge webinar series brought to you by Pacific Gas and Electric Company's Energy Training Center and ACI. Jim Fitzgerald is the presenter today.
Howdy.
Should be able to see my slides. However, my slides are not moving. Oh, here we go. So the recordings are for this and Monday's session are at 1000homechallenge.com news and events. And if you have any problem with this slideshow being out of sync, contact Eric Kaufman, ekaufman@affordablecomfort.org. Lots of resources on ACI's website, so these slides are just a little bit of an advertisement for information that you can access. But in particular, we've got an event coming up in Colorado soon, so if you're at all interested in that, check it out on their website. We've also got all the past webinars archived on the website. They're under the resources heading. PG&E is a source of an amazing number of classes that are free, particularly for contractors and builders. Check their website out as well. I wanted to just clarify that this webinar is, while being funded by PG&E, does not imply any kind of endorsement of anything that Jim or myself would say regarding products, opinions, those kinds of things. So a few things about the 1000 Home Challenge. 1000 Home Challenge is currently a pilot. The goal is to demonstrate the potential for 70%+ reductions in homes through a combination of mechanisms, efficiency, behavioral choices, renewable energy solutions. Obviously, dense pack is part of how you would capture the efficiency potential. We have two options for determining how you define each home's individual threshold. One is based on where you're starting from, a 75% reduction in verifiable recent energy use. And option B is based on an absolute level of performance. We incorporate zip code, house size, heating source, and number of occupants to determine your threshold allowance. This is an example of the threshold allowance for a number of sites in California. This is assuming a 2,000 square foot house, three people in the house, electric heat. The key thing that you should be able to notice is that the heating portion is a relatively small part of the total allowance. That means that when you consider where homes start from, you've got to make a fairly significant reduction in order to get down to a level that would be in the range of 1 to 2,000 kilowatt hours a year equivalent. But the reason I wanted to show a few of these slides regarding the 1000 Home Challenge is to convey that deep reductions is the context for this webinar. In many cases, we're talking about judgment calls as to what you do or how much you do or when you do it. And the point I want to make here is there's no right answer. In most cases, it depends on the context. In the case of the 1000 Home Challenge, we're assuming the homeowner or building owner is paying the price, assuming most of the risk. The project objectives are to demonstrate reductions deeper than most people think are possible, and that there's a high value on learning, incredibly high value on pushing boundaries. So the point that I'm trying to make here is, depending on where you're coming from and who your customer is or what role you're playing, whether or not you're part of an initiative, a utility company, you're a private contractor, a consultant, a homeowner, all of those things have a huge impact on what decisions you're making. And we do not, we're not assuming a particular context other than a high value on demonstrating what's possible. Learning objectives today are listed here. Jim will be expanding on what he addressed last time, but primarily addressing the whole issue of how you get to the interstitial air leakage that connects to the outside walls. The main focus of the webinar on Monday was how you make sure, while you're insulating the wall cavities, that you get complete coverage at a high enough density. This this is adding to, okay, but how do you get to all those other places and what are those other places? How do you recognize and how do you think about a building? So key points, complete the low leakage envelope. If you can't get to the bypass, where do you go? How do you find those framing edges? Targeted dense pack, how do you re-insulate cavities, particularly with bats, which we absolutely is a possibility. Some of the water insulation requirements for thicker and taller cavities, tricky stuff that you might be doing if you're shooting for an R40 or R50 or R60 wall, and then some issues relating to moisture, what happens with different insulation materials. We would like you to ask questions throughout, and we will be reserving some time at the end specifically to go over questions, but we'll also be, I'll be asking questions as Jim goes through his presentation. We will be posting answers to the questions that were asked, so that that'll be part of what's on the archive for the Thousand Oak Challenge. Just a reminder, we're not addressing a lot of the details, the how-to, the sort of really critical stuff that makes the difference between making a job work or not. That's beyond the scope of this webinar, and we encourage you to check out the DensePack sidewall insulation video. It goes into those details. Jim Fitzgerald is a person who's been working both as a contractor, as a trainer, as a person struggling with how you take what you know and translate it and make it possible for a lot of people to understand, comprehend, and do. He's a person who has absolutely been committed to empowering the people who do work in the field to do things well, to understand how to do it well, to have the tools and knowledge to do it well, and working with programs and initiatives so that those program and initiatives support contractors doing a job well done rather than create conflicts with that. Jim's been involved not only in doing DensePack for years, doing training for the weatherization sector and utilities for years, but also more recently working to develop BPI's criteria for air leakage control and working with a number of insulation vendors on the whole issue of how you verify whether or not DensePack is DensePack. It's a privilege to work with Jim and have him part of this webinar series. So here's Jim.
Okay. Good afternoon. Part two is, show my screen.
You got it. We see your screen.
That's good. Where's the... I don't see the... why don't we use your screen for a minute?
To do that, we need to go back to me.
I'm not seeing what we were looking for.
How about this one here? Oh, no, that's the wrong one. That looks like it.
There you go.
Well, that's me. So I believe right now, Jim, you're seeing my screen and you can move around on it. Please verify that.
I'm seeing just my notes. So I'll turn that off. I was trying to open this up again. I see the screen. I can move around on it.
Great. Good.
Can I advance it?
You should be able to.
I don't see that happening.
Tell me in all advance.
Okay. Simplest way to express this is go back to DensePack in 104. This is not an air barrier. DensePack is a way to address leakage paths that we can't access, that aren't going to be sealed with conventional air sealing techniques. The comparison between DensePack is with doing nothing. We always want to do an air barrier and do the best work and do good preparation with the right tested materials. But in cases where cavities are left alone, this is way better than leaving them alone. DPI requires for their, in their standard, this is the envelope standard, leakage paths that can't be sealed, get packed with high density pneumatically applied insulation or air impermeable foam in these cavities in order to reduce airflow through the building shell. This allows us to get a complete coverage on shells that would be left untreated on a big fraction of them, their surface. Let's go down one. Quick recap, what did we do last week? When you block airflow through the sidewalls, you also block the leakage from everything connected to the walls. An insulation void is the loss of that is the R-value improvement of the insulation in the square footage of the void. If you leave a large section of the air leakage alone, you could lose all the benefit of the air leakage, a much bigger fraction. We don't see the final air leakage total drop until the last of the connected leaks are sealed. Critical components for wall insulation. You get the machine set up to deliver the material at the density that's specified for that product, 3.5 pounds per cubic foot for cellulose, 2.2 for several of the approved fiberglass, high-performance fiberglass products. Next, you open every cavity. That means make a hole, check side to side, make sure that every stud cavity is found. And then in filling, the tube goes all the way to the top, all the way to the bottom. 100% of each cavity gets filled. If you're doing two-hole, you want the placement of the hole to be close enough to the top and the bottom that it's at high density where it is at the end. And you may need to use a plumb line to make sure there's no blockers. A little bit more complicated. But for every cavity, they have to be filled completely and they have to be tight to the next cavity, which is filled. And then the installation is all at a uniform density. So this is solid, 100%. And while we're installing it, the installer can check, turn the blower door on for a minute and puff smoke next to the cavity that they filled. It should stop the smoke and not get pulled in. Or they should redo the cavity. And then as they do 3, 4, 5, 10 cavities, confirm that the bag count in pounds per square foot matches the pounds per square foot usage of the target density. If it's 2x4, that cellulose is about 1 pound per square foot and fiberglass is about 0.6 pounds. A lot of variation in the world, a lot of variation in the houses, and it's not useful to get more specific than those numbers. While you're learning, it's really important to have an IR check on every job you do and then learn how to beat the IR. These procedures allow the technician to be certain that he's gotten everything on the house so that there is no reason to have anything missed, which means you're doing the quality assurance as you go. A well-done job is you plan for it, verify as you go, and then check to make sure you got it. Next slide. Hello.
Yep.
How does that advance? What is connected to the sidewalls? The edges of interior walls. The floor plan often has the foundation changes, so offset walls. Common walls with a multi-floor framing is open to the walls going horizontal. Drop soffits, stairways are attached. Porch roofs, cantilevered floors, bay windows. Chimneys are, in some cases, half in and half out of the wall. Plumbing chases, duct chases. Plumbing and electrical systems are, unfortunately, run right through the exterior walls cases. Attics are also connected to the walls and crawl spaces, porch attics, decks. Where a lower roof on a multi-level roof attaches, that roof step flashing ties into the wall, and the bottom of that roof, the kick-out flashing, ties into the wall and in many cases pours water into it. Find that at dormers and split levels. Next slide. What's connected? Okay, where might the framing edges be found in this mobile home kind of structure? How many different areas could allow framing to get exposed to the outside?
So people could respond either by just jotting their answers down or by using the question function and sending us their answers. Just give you a minute or two.
This is a building we did in a conference presentation that was live, and we finished the building with the participants in 1989, and it's still in pretty good shape, which is reassuring.
So Eric, you want to share some of what people responded with?
Please don't say
we've got exterior walls, corners, roof, and floor junctions.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Porch intersecting house.
Chimney.
Yep. A couple of those.
Dormer intersecting attic, roof, floor.
Good, good.
You want the next slide, Jim?
Yeah, please. I've seen that before. Okay, the wall surface here is over 5,000 square feet. Plus, there is an attached porch roof, offset floors, attic stairway, pocket door, crawl space, a couple other things. This is the bed and breakfast, and it was a conference training site in 1989. And Indiana Weatherization is responsible for this quality work. Great team. So it's a large surface area. This is a diagram that Tom Wilson with Energy Exchange did to kind of open up what it is we're looking for. And often the detailing that happens on these corners where framing attaches is taken care of for structural reasons, but there isn't any air protection. And the area that can travel through all these is will dominate how the house works. Tan. This is where we would target using high-density insulation. Make sure we always get those spots when we're doing the walls. And then if we're coming into a house that's already been insulated, we would selectively choose to redo those spots and make sure that there's no free air movement at those intersections. Yeah, next slide.
You have a pointer if you want to use it.
Well, good.
And we've got a great question from Bruce Heft. It was, have you used or do you suggest using the video probes that have a gooseneck and allow you to sort of, I know plumbers use them to find things. Oftentimes they've got 12, 15 feet of probe. Have you used that to explore the inner cavities?
Yeah, we have. We had, I almost lost a $5,000 one TV in the cavity, but we're probing with the same tool that we're insulating. We're probing while we're insulating. So if the video probe, that would be really good for troubleshooting and designing something special but we didn't know. This tube, if it goes all the way up and all the way down, we're sure that the cavity has been traversed, but that's how we install it. So we're sure that the cellulose or fiberglass or mineral wool is distributed out to that point and beyond.
But let's say you suspected you had a recessed light. You could go up and check it with the video camera in order to see whether or not there was a blockage or whether or not a pocket door was open to the exterior door.
You can try that. It's really tough because the air travels not just in line of sight. And it's disappointing how frequently you see dust coming out places that it's not freaking possible for it to get there. There's no way you can think about it traveling where it does. The connections are surprising. And it's good to have video, but it's this is a method that works with the people that are actually hired to do it. Often they don't speak English, can't read. Looking for specific details with the borescope or camera, that's good on specific stuff to design the job.
But don't trust it is what I hear you saying. Keep going, Jim. I don't want to slow you down here.
It's nobody on this job is there just to look. So we want to know the cavity is done. It'd be good to check inside, the inside surfaces. There's a couple things that we didn't do when we were doing this job, and you'll see evidence of at least one of them. But that what Gary Nelson has in his hand goes all the way up, and he pulls it down about a foot at a time as it packs, and that allows the velocity to get reestablished and keep the pack uniform. The tightness is set by the machine adjustment. Let's go next. The one thing we want to do is get the job started. So on this house, we had 4 or 5 crews doing walls at the same time. At that time, we used the tightness, the feel of the block of insulation as the quality check as we progressed from hole to hole. Now we're doing that with chemical smoke, and the blower door just popped on for a few seconds. We want to see that what we thought was the right adjustment actually stops air. And using chemical smoke as an indicator to stop air is common for air sealers. So let's go next. Next slide. All right, when we look at the front of the, go back. Look at the upstairs, look at the downstairs. So one of the important things that we want to do today is to have you look at where might there be something open. Where is there an unexplained or a covered up change? And here we've got a inside and an outside corner and an angle, and the square upstairs can't match the angle downstairs. Why we're talking about this is spots that might be leaking that we can't get at, we do want to open up. And that's one of our learning objectives today, is how do you recognize places you would want to open? This is one of them. Next, how do you open it? On this one, the porch ceiling is beaded board, which is very easy to open. You cut on a, with a thin blade, you cut on a joist and then cut the tongue on one of the boards and pop out the adjacent couple. This opening is big enough to visually see the, inspect what's happening at the sheathing plane, you know, behind the siding. If the siding went all the way up and there wasn't a porch, we're going to look behind that. Let's take a look upstairs. Let's look in the hole. Next slide. What do we see in that? Okay, here's the framing that's holding the beaded board ceiling. Here's the roof rafter. And then these are sheathing boards, solid wood, with 1/4 to 3/8 inch gaps every 6 inches, 7 inches, that cross the open floor joists. So if if the camera person, myself, was better, we could actually see back into the house through these joints. When we see this, what it tells us, along with, we already know that it's balloon framing and the tube goes upstairs, it goes to the second floor when we're standing downstairs, there isn't any worry about either the air not getting blocked by cellulose or fiberglass mineral wool when we do it, or a big mess happening at places we don't know, out in the porch. So the porch is not connected. Don't have to worry about it. We can go forward without cutting anything. The choice that we want you all to be making is when you look in a place like this, you decide if this is an opening that nobody has seen before, do we do this with barrier materials? Do we get rigid foam or metal or structural, plywood to close off the opening and fasten it and then seal? And that would limit our use of DenseVac only to the corners where we couldn't get a barrier installed. This one, it looks like the walls are going to take care of it just fine like they are, and we're not going to have any trouble. Everything's just smooth, so we can go ahead. Next slide. Oops, spoke too soon. Underneath that transition, there's a pocket door which is set into a cavity that's open to all the framing. The ceiling joist spaces are open above, and the wall cavity is open into the end of that pocket door. So when cellulose was, this stuff was being blown into an adjacent wall cavity, we're seeing it in the living room where it came out the pocket door. Now, this pocket door has been unhooked from the pocket, and so it's moved out of the way. What we found when that happened is there was enough cellulose in there that the pocket door wouldn't operate properly, wouldn't go back where it belongs. That's a bit of a bother. So what do you do? Next slide. What's one option? Very high tech. So we want to stuff something that's going to allow air to get out, but capture the dust. If we had really good control, we could have two-part foam, sprayed in there, but that wasn't one of the options on the job site. Now, what I want you to look at is the photograph on the right is taken at a 45 or 60 degree angle up. It's actually looking at the track where the ceiling joists meet the wall. So that's the floor-wall connection, the upper yellow arrow. This is the floor-wall connection. So that's what we were looking at from the porch side when we were up on the ladder with our head through the beaded board. One thing that's really a valuable but unusual trait is to be able to remember what you're looking at when you're inside, and you want to find what you're looking at outside. So stuff the fiberglass in so that there's no more dust, get the mess out of the cavity in the bottom, and that can be packed. And the blowing material will find all of the leaks and all the air paths because it's pressurized. We don't have to design a flashing for this. It's a complicated leak to get at, a complicated detail up on top. And it's a couple inches wide. Next slide. Matt took care of it. It was great. Okay, the next not wall that we're looking at is the stairway to the attic that goes from a door on the second floor to a landing up on the floored attic. And so you see on the left, the top riser is in place, but the floorboard has been opened to allow this is actually the 2-inch hose that comes from the blower. There isn't a tube on it. We're trying to do this fast. And so we made access into the space between the treads and risers and the plaster below alongside the framing in the stairwell. And so that stairwell volume gets packed underneath the wood, and then the walls of the stairwell get packed as well, and the landing. And that reduces the uncontrolled air movement in that kind of a freeway intersection of framing, and God knows how it connects. Once it's packed full, it can connect all at once and nothing happens. Right picture is installer has made a hole into each cavity and he's doing the same treatment but from below. Better to have a narrower hose and take a little more time and be able to patch the hole. And the stiff sidewall tube is much better for going up anyway. That way we have a kind of a total boundary on that stairwell. The sidewalls get done as well. Okay, next. And the door gets weatherstripped and insulated. Next slide. That's the stairwell. Okay, so the crews finished the walls. There was a attic air sealing done and floor. We'll see that in a minute. We did a blower door and it hadn't changed very much. Lo and behold, on the left side, the left picture, this is the same location. There's a like 30, 32 inch by 30 to 32 inch opening from the conditioned part of the crawl space out to the unconditioned part. Big enough to let a lot of air go through. Dense pack isn't going to show the blower door number reduction or all the savings it could if big openings like this aren't addressed. So part of what we do always is to get every big opening, whether it's in the attic, in the crawl space. And it's a systematic, so we're seeing styrofoam installed and then sealed, wedge sealed, fastened, glued in place by one part foam, blocking the openings into the unheated crawl space. Next, after this was the last big thing. Remember, what's connected to the sidewall? So we thought that all the walls were done. We thought that the attic was done. We thought that everything big was done. This is the point where some programs would start doing interior or minor or secondary air sealing for comfort, weather stripping windows, doors, other things. What we're going to do instead of that is confirm that what we hoped, that all of these connections are actually working. So it was dark now. We depressurized the building to 50 pascals with a blower door. Lo and behold, the number was way better. And we looked at the entire inside surface of the plaster with an infrared camera after, 20 minutes, half an hour. We only found one spot on the whole building where there was active air leakage. Let's look at the next slide. Next slide. Nope, not that one. Go back up. Where's the ceiling one?
That one's not here.
Oh, you took out the, doesn't matter. It was the spot underneath where I was holding my shoulder, pushing the cellulose up the stairway. It's a little bit embarrassing. Anyway, that was another 200 or 300 in the blower door change from, do we still have the blower door number?
No.
Okay, anything in the attic?
No.
So the floored attic is just like a wall, and so that had some insulation, and the floor was blown on the attic, so pretty much all of the exposed surface on the walls in the attic, so 7,000 square feet, was done with dense pack in the cavity. And 9 square feet was done with styrofoam in the crawl space and some bypass sealing materials. And all of these relatively big connections were at least addressed with a reduced leakage material. Next. The purpose of what we just looked at is to get a picture of going from start to finish to connect the cavities with the areas we can seal into a reduced airflow, continuous it's not a barrier, but it's an enclosure. Better than having it open. And it's not a barrier, but it's a first step. And the blower door number on the building went from 6,500 to just over 3,000 without doing the next step. So there's plenty of air sealing left to do. Relatively big building. That's done. What we're looking at now are a set of different details about access. So one question is, if you had a floor system that was strapped or there were drops with air leakage to places you couldn't get at that were 10, 15 feet from any place you could reach, what might you do? So this is showing we're using a 20-foot long, somewhat larger diameter water suction tube that's straightened out to pack tight the front and back perimeter joist that meets the gable end, making it simpler. We want to pack tight or put a rigid barrier around the whole outside edge of the floor system so no air can circulate one way or the other. This is the way we can do the parts we can't reach. We use a barrier on the parts that we can, the knee wall bypass. The whole tube is going through.
So you're packing, in that case, you're packing the entire floor joist because it's adjacent to a leak, another a potential leakage point, correct?
It's adjacent to outside. And there's a photograph in another location that shows 12, 14 feet into that floor cavity is a drop where the kitchen wall meets the pantry and God knows what's going on, but there's no way to get at there to seal it. It's a little shed roof thing. This is much better, and it takes much better for the installer. Maybe better for air leakage control would be to strip the roof off and unbuild that part of the house to put in a piece of sheetrock.
So this idea of blocking the perimeter or the adjacent cavities is also applied to interior walls that intersect the exterior, correct?
Correct. Any framing space that would allow an escape route for the air, we need to handle either with a barrier or by packing. We can't leave anything open and expect to succeed trying to control the air. And we want to control the air first. Curious thing is if we're using the insulation to reduce the air, maybe it doesn't control it, but we get down to a reasonable amount. We end up with insulation as a byproduct, so that part's done. And we move on to the next one. So we don't want to leave anything open as a short circuit. We'd find that later with infrared. If we infrared after the fact, and especially if we use pressure, it will shine. Real easy to see what we missed. We can do it then. Next slide.
I want to back up to one from a question. A question was asked, this technique of dense packing a stairwell was primarily to minimize air movement, not to insulate. So is there another way to air seal a stairwell that may be more cost-effective with a different product like caulk or styrene? But this is actually exterior. I mean, you do want to insulate this too, aren't you?
Yeah, you do, and that's just a misunderstanding. None of the inch-by-inch barrier methods work nearly as well as this. There's really awkward access to get at where the leak is, which is inside the framing underneath the stair treads. And the exterior walls are tied in, the floor joist is tied in, the upper floor joist is tied in. Try it, put your styrofoam and caulking gun up and see what you get. And what's happened by introducing this is when we do this first, the next thing we need is ventilation or a direct vent furnace, power vent water heater, often that the quibbling about you didn't do that detail well enough we actually do need to put ventilation in so that the building works. Okay. On the left, we have a diagram of a party wall, a mated firewall that's got a separation between two wood members and the sheetrock that's on either side of the finished spaces. Can't tell, but that party wall is in this wall behind the trim. We're going to look in here. We're actually going to make a hole in the sheetrock and run the sidewall tube up to the top of this floor and then down to the ground from this stance and pack in a little bit at the end of this web truss. This is one of the openings that the kitchen fan installer made, and he couldn't put the kitchen fan because of plumbing or something else being in his way and just left it open. This band joist that connects to all of the spaces in that, it's an eightplex, was very, very cold, and cold weather when we checked it with the infrared. And that needed, the two things that this set of buildings needed more than anything was the edge of the firewall, party wall, blocked, and these huge openings closed. There are three or four brands of cellulose that have been approved for use in new construction UL listed details for frame party walls. It's not unexpected to get a local building official to authorize the use of that material, which is approved for this type of use in this existing building, to stop pipe freezing or whatever. Maybe it's in a place, you know, in California, I don't think you have the frequency of pipe freezing we do. This building froze the pipes every day. JM Spider or any of the high performance fiberglasses are approved or allowed to be put into this kind of a place without affecting the rating of the rated firewall. It's non-combustible. So either the high-performance fiberglass or authorized by the local building official, you could do cellulose to install a firewall that worked and control where the air goes. I was at the air sealing contractor working for these condo owners, and I first started air sealing two units and up and a down. Our cost for doing those two units from the inside, which was ineffective against stopping the pipe freezing, which is why we were there, that cost 25% more than dense packing the party walls and putting sheetrock covering those holes in the perimeter. So we did the whole eight-unit building for less than doing the wrong work piece by piece in the first units we chose.
So speaking of party walls, Jim, is there a significant soundproofing element if you dense pack that wall?
We didn't dense pack the wall. We only blew a foot or two along the outside edge.
Okay, but if you did?
Had we done the wall, maybe. Acoustical transport is complicated, and we've had anecdotes, and we fixed noise complaints in acoustical surfaces, but I don't want to pretend that this is a substitute for a real acoustical design. Maybe it makes it better. It makes it better if we stop airflow, because air is one of the ways noise transports. So if we limit airflow, we're going to have reduced noise transport, but there's a lot of other things that can happen.
Okay, we're about halfway through total time, Jim.
Let's go. Okay, if you look outside on the right, this is a sidewall insulation hole. Through that sidewall insulation hole, our creative individual is going to push a grain sack and then fill it with insulation, and that limits how much wall insulation will spill into the rest of the floor joist system and saves all kinds of trouble that could occur. So that's not an airtight block, but it's a pathway there. Can you change the slide just so we see the bag in place? There we go, and he's going to inflate it now. Next slide. Or hit it again. He puts the bag in with the tube, and he didn't fill it. There we go. So that fills up. Now, when he finishes by packing the exterior wall, that doesn't move, and we don't get big drift of cellulose crossing.
So let me make sure I understand that, Jim. What you're saying is the intent of that bag is to create a big enough block so you can get a truly dense pack on the wall side.
Yeah, without getting in other places that could be a problem. This is not airtight. You know, it's a round plug in a square hole. But when you start getting material building up, it's not going to travel beyond this.
And so you get a good plug on the other side of that when you finish.
Very good. Right.
Got it.
It'll hold the density higher. Bottom line is, get it. You know, get at it any way you can. The hose gives you 10 to 15 feet, and sometimes longer. Next. We've got more access. Next one. Next slide. Okay, so the house on the right is the house that's showing the ceiling on the left. This is a plumbing in a little stem wall that meets the outside. That's my living room, and so we blew cellulose up the gap between the drain pipe and the exterior so the supply pipes wouldn't freeze. Worked great. Next. And that's, we just moved the base. This is, poor guy is underneath the mobile home insulating the belly from below. So Anthony Cox and the training team in Virginia have a mobile home where they've removed some of the surfaces and put plexiglass so people can see how it's insulating. So it's maybe not a 1,000-house challenge, but it's a way to get good insulation than you're accessing from below. Next. Next slide. Okay, here's the floor where there's no way to get at the really limited space on the other side, and so pull the carpet back off the nailer strip and pull the fiberglass or the mineral wool that's halfway in the floor cavity back toward your knees, and then pack tight a block that's going to be 2 or 3 feet and very high density. But we're going through the floor. Next slide.
One question on this one, Jim, is with that knee wall, because that looks like you're on the second floor of a two-story house, correct?
Exactly, right.
What would you do to actually insulate the knee wall in terms of if this was accessible, if it was just 2x4, what would you do to hit that area?
Well, on this one, there was, I think, 6 inches of fiberglass in all the slants and knee walls and everything. This is a fairly high-end, you know, I think it's a condo in Newport Beach, Rhode Island. But the purpose that, why we're there is to stop the air leakage on this building. So this is specifically designed not, it's not about insulation. This is to control the flow of air out that floor joist. I want to stick with that. And insulating the knee wall could be that when he's doing that, enough cellulose is going in, or fiberglass, that it's filling up to the existing space anyway. I don't want to get in trouble, but things like that I blow full, and we actually should have a ventilation space if there's a chute in place, but that's way too little to do anything. Okay, here's John Jennings is helping with it's a really unusual ceiling that the huge airflow, and the ceiling was full of outside air all the time, and the people kept their thermostat a lot, 8-9 degrees higher because it was so cold. It's a radiant problem. So John Jennings is actually going into the side of the drop and taking the acoustical tile off, and we're blowing in a dam 2 feet deep all the way around this odd construction and it dropped the house energy use in the evaluation by, you know, the heating use by 30%, just this feature. Next. Okay. This is maybe contentious, but the black is, JM is doing a follow-up. I asked the manufacturers that are in the dense pack research project to see if they had any experience. Danish researchers, which are going to show an excerpt from, has documented that as the thickness of a cavity, you go like from 2x4 to timber framing, so you've got a 9-inch, 10-inch thick, deep cavity, and they did a 200-day test on a 8-foot-tall wall section. As that thickness of the cavity increases, this is with wood framing and sheetrock, the density of cellulose needed to prevent settling goes up. Now, one of the anecdotes that one of the side observations that they made in their 200-day measurement was in the 9-inch, in the timber frame cavity, even though it didn't settle, horizontal cracks had appeared that went all the way through the block of cellulose and were, you know, a 1/4 inch to 3/8 of an inch wide. I happen to have done 12-inch and 8-inch block filling of a space like that for the Energy Conservatory in their last location, but the wall was 14 feet tall, and there was nothing in between. It wasn't a full cavity. We had a 2x4 sheetrock wall standing inboard of a really smooth epoxy-coated cement block surface. And my cellulose blocks, when we looked at them 10 years later, had continued to move down so that there were horizontal cracks or like lightning bolt cracks that were 2 and 3 inches wide going side to side all through the cellulose, all through the blocks of cellulose. And that was reblown and new cracks developed. Looking at that afterwards, having had a warehouse for quite some time, if you have 14 feet of bags piled one on top of the other, let's see, it's 500 pounds on that bottom bag. The bottom bag isn't as fat as it used to be. Cellulose is not a structural material, and the compression from having 16 feet or 14 feet of 4 pounds per cubic foot, that's 50 or 60 pounds per square foot. The stuff keeps moving. This is something you want to know about if you're considering doing a super insulated wall. I'd use some reinforcement. If you're putting a TJI joist up, they've got knockouts. You could run any number of things horizontally through the knockout. Use a stabilized product with glue. Use a different material. Blanket, you know, bat fiberglass is great. JM is doing a check with spider to see if spider is robust against that kind of extra loading. And so they built, whether it was 16 or 20 feet long or tall, 12-inch square a couple months ago. And it's on a vibration shaker. But we don't see enough, I haven't seen enough in existing homes to even talk about this, but since we're in the 1,000 home challenge and in some of the most careful retrofit areas in the country, we got to talk about this. So be careful. Larger cavities need higher density. Next slide, and you'll see did you take the calculation off, or is it here? Yeah. Okay. So on the bottom, with a 2x4 cavity, 3.5 pounds per square foot is the absolute minimum to keep from settling if the block is exposed, if the cellulose, if the material is exposed to cycling, if moisture cycles between 50% and 80%. If there's no moisture cycling, if this is inside and stays at 50, then you're about 7 to 10% lower is all that's needed to keep it from settling. But what's important here is as the cavity gets thicker, the requirement for density goes up. So it's almost 4 pounds with a 2x6, 4.2 with a 2x8, 4.5 pounds per, I've got square foot here, it should be cubic foot, a typo. 4.5 pounds per cubic foot. And then this curve extends as the cavity gets bigger. But 12-inch thick, that's a dandy wall.
Jim, a couple of questions or comments. One is that, but that's just for the 8-foot high wall, so those, you have that, seen that same slope if you have a taller wall, right? Because you've got the weight bearing down on the bottom.
We don't know. My guess is the slope would be steeper.
Right.
Because this is looking at the weight of the material and the friction of the surface that it's attached to. And then the structure, you know, it's newsprint or ground cardboard, you know, whatever that manufacturer's using. But this shows that putting in, in our city, in Minneapolis, we just had a demonstration with a contractor blowing in 2x12 walls at 2.5 pounds per square foot, per cubic foot, and recording it on film. Maybe it works out for them. I don't want to predict anything, but this doesn't look like it was a good idea. But nice thing is you can always fill it again.
Well, a couple, we had a lot of conversations, actually. I spoke to you quite a bit about this issue, and I also spoke to Terry Brennan and Gary Nelson about the whole issue of what happens when you've got a bigger cavity. And Gary's observation was the slipperiness of the surface is really critical, and that in most houses that we've been doing dense pack, they tended to be older houses historically, and the fact that the plaster and the lath and the boards is obviously much, much less slippery than poly or drywall. Yeah. So Gary was projecting that we might see this problem more in just even 2x6 or walls. But then the other issue was, it was Terry Brennan that said that if you're dense packing a wall, a double wall, for example, it's very possible that the weight causes that wall just to expand slightly. So if you've got a double wall, you're not connecting the front to the back. And if that wall shifts in the middle, just moving out a quarter inch and a half inch, that could cause the insulation material to slip as well. But George Nesbitt sent the comment saying that he had cracking in a 2x6 netted wall that was installed at 4 pound density. So the key thing is I don't think people very often go back and look 6 months, 2 years, 5 years later in this case.
Yeah, I think ever is a good way to say it. The I have slides that show this happening on its own with where the 5 foot cavity that was blown full settled 20, 22 inches in 5 feet. And so it settled to something that's approximately 4 pounds per cubic foot in that 5 foot height on its own with no nothing. And I've seen settling a lot, except in 2x4 walls that have lath and plaster, like you say. And several of those, not several, hundreds of those have, you look at them with infrared and you can't tell the difference between the nominal R3.7 cellulose and the nominal R1.2 pine, that the density is so low that it's not even there, but it still doesn't settle. So what Gary is saying is certainly true on the narrow cavities that are rough.
But if you had cracking, the cracking wouldn't necessarily mean that the wall is going to have air movement. You're just going to lose a little bit of insulation value, I would think.
I don't know. It was Gary's building that we saw this first. One thing that was disturbing is that the cracking didn't stop after it was fixed. The shifting, the block of cellulose was not stable. it continued to move. There's a plate tectonics going on. Maybe we're making masonite at the bottom. I don't know. But there are things I haven't done that again, and I haven't. I don't have a solution for the use of that material in that location. I think it's you need to do something to make it not do that.
But bottom line is, it's important to well, like Tad Everhart in Portland, Oregon, I think has a 16 or 18 or 20 foot high wall that he had dense pack, but he left an access from the attic so he can go back and check and top it off. But some houses are being designed in such a way with a double wall or these insulated cavities where there is no access. But just even putting an interior trim board or something would allow you to check and make sure that you've got you don't have settling.
Yeah, you can always go in and put more in. That doesn't have to be. You don't have to have a valve. Okay, here's a different issue. So this is a flat roof, or not flat, but close to it, 2x10 that we dense packed 10 years before this photograph was taken, or actually 11. And prior to going into a bigger project, this is a new addition. So this addition, the 10 inches of our work has no ice showing. The new addition has got 4 inches of ice across the back. So one thing we wanted to do is see what happens. And next slide. This is violates code, and this is a moisture hazard, right? It's a big risk. We have the next slide. I want to show the monitor. Whoop. Next slide. There we go. So, go back to the Delmhorst. Right. So when we were setting the house up, we had the homeowner allowed me to go into a closet in the middle of the house and put remote moisture sensing moisture pins to have a moisture measuring station and a thermocouple at the roof deck in the main part, the old 10 inches of cellulose part. And what we're seeing is 78 degrees on the roof deck at 1 in the afternoon when it's 10 degrees outside. And we're seeing the moisture meter on the pin reading 20%, where at 9 in the morning it was saturated. What's happening, I opened it up and done this on, in 96, I went to 10 buildings that I had insulated flat roofs 10 years before to measure the roof moisture in December and January. What's the worst case for moisture accumulation? This was one of them. Moisture cycling at night, the moisture that's distributed throughout the cavity collects on the cold roof deck. The sun comes out and it goes back into the cellulose. The top inch or half an inch shows some dampness, and other places, and well, I've got another picture of that. The wood most likely is treated now with the flame retardant chemical that's in the cellulose with this cycling of moisture. Anyway, 10 years and there's no sign of any issues at all. Why I'm showing this is that there's all kinds of talk about extremes and what happens when it's perfect, what happens when it's terrible. The reality is there's a lot of places where there's a little bit of moisture that is cycling. It goes back and forth. It doesn't freaking matter. That one thing the cellulose does, if you've got 10 inches at 4 pounds, that's 3.5 pounds per square foot of additional moisture-carrying mass. And it takes a lot of water to get that block elevated. At the same humidity level, cellulose will pull moisture out of the wood. Not to say that it's okay to have moisture accumulate, but if there's a moderate amount that is below what causes a problem and it isn't building up, not to worry about it. how do you know when you have that happening? Let's go to the next slide. Well, this is additional. So people ask, can we blow insulation when there's batting in place? Take a look. We put in 2 pounds per square foot into a 9.5-inch frame that has a 10-inch bat. And this is different than it was before. As a business or as a benefit you're giving the homeowner, I don't recommend doing this. If there's the fiberglass works great, unless there's some reason that it's not working. I was there and I thought the snow melting was an indication that things weren't put together probably as well as they could be. When fiberglass is done the right way, it works just great. But this is now packed and we know it will.
But Jim, depending on,
go ahead. We can do walls. Pardon?
Air would still move through that, wouldn't it?
Air moves through the cellulose, even if it's cellulose. The difference, there's a research project going on, and we're measuring, BPI is measuring, funded by DOE and NREL, the actual airflow through the cavity in the long dimension. Not here, we're looking at the 10-inch up and down, but we're the measurement they're making is in the parallel with the surface of the cavity, because that's really how the walls are and how they leak. Haven't done the fiberglass yet, and then the discussion about whether to do cavities that are already insulated, we really want to know this. How low can we go? I don't have a picture.
But if airflow was the problem in this cavity, wouldn't it be better to just push the fiberglass back and get a, well, and put an air barrier there?
I don't know about anything with the fiberglass. I think if there's air, if you really wanted to not move airflow, then you seal this edge to the top plate or to the air barrier that's in the wall up to the roof deck, and you put 4 inches or 5 inches of rigid urethane board over the roof and seal the perimeter, so you follow the International Residential Code section 806.4, where you put an air impermeable insulation in an air barrier connected to an air barrier. You want to stop the air, you use an air barrier. And all of these, you know, like what I'm doing here, you know, pushing stuff in with cellulose, I got the cellulose truck. This is my customer. I want him to be happy, so I'm giving him a little bit more where he's got a remodel job. But I think this is all, you know, that's a debate. We don't know the amount of flow that goes through. A house that I did with Joe Stiebrick, intending to stop moisture condensation, we did the vault. It was a 2x8 with 6-inch fiberglass. And the house volume was, I'm not that good with the measurements, somewhere between 90 and 100,000 cubic feet. The house CFM50 before we started was just under 5,000. Dense packing the vault, which is through the fiberglass, dropped it to 1,700. 1,700 CFM 50 in 100,000 cubic foot volume is just over one air change an hour at 50. So the number sounds really good. And what we made was a colder roof that now condenses more moisture than it did before, and we lost the roof the first year. That was a $50,000, $60,000 callback with black ooze running down the white siding. Just getting the air leakage number low doesn't tell you that you're stopping the air where it's still warm. It could be that you're still allowing the air to go a long distance along against something that's cold, and so the air dehumidifies itself by dropping all of its moisture in the building over places that aren't designed to collect moisture. So really don't want to be showing or encouraging any packing of vaulted ceilings. This is the only picture that I had that was real easy to see that, yes, we can blow through fiberglass or mineral wool or cellulose or whatever. And as long as it's not 3.5, 4 pounds, 4.5 pound density now, we can redo it. It doesn't matter. Whether you need to, whether you do it or not is another question. So for programs that I work on, I am opposed to redoing existing insulated cavities unless there's another presenting problem like high leakage, high bills, mold, frost, new construction in the middle of Mississippi River downtown Minneapolis. The city hired us to come and fix it, and they had ice on the sheetrock inside the room 4 feet high. The north wall in the kitchen had solid ice on the sheetrock in the room. I'd never seen that in my life.
We have 20 minutes left, Jim. Let's move on, okay?
Yeah. Anyway, this is a picture of cellulose that's wet, that's in the wall of our lake cabin. The kitchen wall was wet. My wife wouldn't go up there because of the smell of mold. It wasn't from this. That cellulose was wet for many years. Look at the sheetrock paper behind it. That's like brand new. It's not possible to have sheetrock wet, sheetrock paper wet that long and not have mold growth. There's no mold growth. Let's look at the next picture. What does a wall look like? I redid the roof. I didn't do the kickout flashing well. The framing had to be replaced on the two studs that are in that area, but the bottom where the cellulose is was wet. When I opened that up, it was wet. No mold was growing. I think there's a interesting fungal suppression, at least with boric acid, and that's something to think about. Okay, can you see that has been wet for a while? Next slide. Okay, on the left, there's wind, so I'm up in the bathroom or the bedroom, and chemical smoke is going out from the room into the space between the sheetrock and the outside sheathing. It's going down into the wall cavity. But look how small this gap is that is carrying it. Can you see that? I can't see it. It's too small to see. This air leak, go to the next slide. This air leak took out this much of the sheathing. Freaking nightmare. This is a tiny amount of moisture that goes in, never comes out. This is not what we just saw with the other material. This wall has very low moisture carrying capacity. The other wall has more, and it's got a fungal suppressant. This homeowner bragged about never letting his house get below 50% humidity, and he's in a northern suburb of Minneapolis. He took his stucco off because he wanted to change it to cultured stone. So not very many homeowners change their stucco or their cladding like their cars. But can you see this, where the OSB is gone? There's other places. The party wall rotted out, the edge of the duck chase rotted out, but I thought this would be interesting. Very, very, very small air leakage that deposits moisture in a place that it can't get out. I can go back just one. Let's look at that. That bothers me. I've been teaching people, training people for way too long. You do the biggest stuff first, little stuff won't hurt you. Well, Mr. Richard here that was running his humidifier higher than it is safe in this climate with a incomplete house proved me different, proved me wrong.
So the point is, if you have very high humidity and if you have pressure acting, forcing that humid air, it doesn't take a big leak to create a problem.
I don't think this is going to happen in California. So I want to qualify this, that if that wall is hot, it doesn't matter. We looked at roofs and floor. I was in 100, 150 Florida attics, not even a speck of what's in every Minnesota attic. So that's not something to scare California about, but I just want to show the moisture carrying capacity and some of the considerations for product selection. I think mass, the ability to carry some moisture is important if the house has any moisture transport. And I'll shut up. Next, questions.
So, Jim, obviously cellulose can hold a lot of more humidity, but can also move moisture and dissipate moisture. Could you just mention the difference between
really, really important, really important. No fiber insulation is a roof. There's no fiber insulation that takes the place of flashing. There's no fiber insulation that makes flange windows without connection to the, with no weather barrier, that makes them okay. Insulation is just insulation. If there's a leak where there's water going in, you're screwed. I mean, you got to fix the leak. You can't have a leak. Water runs in and it'll build up. So we can't mix the R value, the moisture carrying capacity, the air leakage effectiveness of these kind of really not that different fiber products put into a wall, one of them that's got no roof and one of them that has one. You know, the roofing, the flashing, the weather barrier, you know, it's got to be put together shingle style and not run water into the wall. That's a higher priority than even if there is insulation. And what kind, if the wall is together, it doesn't matter. We can use anything we want. You can put cellulose or high-performance fiberglass or mineral wool in any of the walls that you'd put blanket insulation or cotton insulation if you like that, or netted or damp spray. It doesn't matter. These are minor. You can't spray two-part foam cavity by cavity well enough to keep that wall safe against water that's leaking in through the siding and hole in there. You really need to have the water control as a separate thing that needs to be handled directly. I don't want to mix.
Yeah, and I think the point is that you could have a house that has a pre-existing condition that didn't create a problem because it did have more drying potential and the insulation could tip it. But it could also make it tip.
Yeah. The homeowners that I meet are dishonest, and when they have something go wrong, the first thing they look for is other people's money. And two of them in the wintertime, when I've been putting sidewall insulation in, they've been solid ice from the sheetrock to the outside plywood, solid 4 inches of ice, and it's right behind the humidifier, and they're putting 15, 20 gallons a day in. Or, what's his name? Guy comes back from Barbados. He likes it, so there he is next to the airport running at 85 degree dew point, and it's 10 degrees outside. There's water running out of every orifice in that house. Everything completely loads up. There's intermittent wetting that goes on that causes huge damage, and water goes in and can't get out. Nice people from the Gulf Coast ran the humidity high during the holidays, and they lost the equity in their house. They, you know, failed a moisture inspection. They couldn't sell the house. It took 6 months to dry out from 2 weeks. That's Minneapolis. Minneapolis is different. If water comes in, you got a problem.
Okay, I want to move on to some questions, and we need you to have short answers in order to get through all these, okay?
Sure.
Question, if you've got an exhaust vent from a furnace running through a joist bay, how would you air seal and dense pack that, or could you safely address that?
If it's done well, what we don't want to have is a 90% plus, a condensing combustion appliance that's got a joint that's buried in construction that isn't sealed. If it's, 3-inch Schedule 40 PVC, 2-inch Schedule 40 PVC that's got no openings, it's fine.
What if it's not a condensing furnace? Could you use mineral wool?
No. Leave the space, because God knows what's going to happen. If I've got, that's another picture. So we've got a supposedly 90 plus water heater on a building. It's venting 10 feet above the back sidewalk, and the stalagmite, what's the one on the ground? It's 5 feet tall, 2-3 feet in diameter. Because the adjustment's wrong, it's not condensing, so there's a huge amount. You got a gallon of water for every 100,000 BTUs that you burn, new water. If that's being delivered to this cold pipe, and it's a metal pipe, that's you can't have that. You don't want anything that's going to catch that water. And there's a clearance requirement for B-vent. You mentioned the house in Cleveland. That's how that homeowner had his three of his furnace water heater systems set up, and one of them rusted out and vented into the basement all winter. That's a non-code. They have to be listed for horizontal, for positive pressure.
Okay, next question. Next question, what's the range of cost? And obviously it varies a lot geographically and depending on what the house offers, but what would the range be for an average 1,000 square foot balloon frame house for sidewall insulation done correctly, a complete job?
Depends on the contractor. Buck and what's a half, $2 a foot, dollar and a quarter to $2.50.
And what if you have stucco on the outside?
Well, if the stucco costs, I'm not up to date. I paid $2.50 a hole to have it patched. It's probably $5 now. I don't know. I patch my own stucco, though. So you make smaller holes. It's really easy. So you're looking at $2.50, $3. We've got a published price list in a statewide program in Massachusetts, where all of the contractors have the same rules and the same standards, and everybody's working together. And
so, how much extra does it cost to do usually from the inside?
Depends on what degree of finish, how much stored stuff is in the house. If it's empty, if there's nobody there, that's going to be cheaper. If you have computers and electronics with stored magnetism, where you have to double bag it, dust bag it, or move it to a different location, and you have to keep a dust-free site, what's it cost to mitigate asbestos or lead? So I think you could run. You're looking at something that would range from $1,000 to $25,000. Just for that extra,
In other words, big range of labor costs too, significant.
How do you protect dust? So if it's a, my daughter is just back from the hospital from having anaphylactic shock. We don't know what was the cause. That was one of the customers. In that house, how do you do the inside insulation? How careful do you want to be? Wrongful death is really expensive, and not to be coarse, but if people have, if there's a personal injury involved, if there's really expensive, Gary Nelson and I have been in houses a lot. One of the buildings, the glass cabinet that I bumped with the blower door frame was, $250,000. Something like this, very special stuff. You have to protect the contents. You know, it's not a priceless deal. But
okay,
$2, $3, it's about the same. You have to plastic everything. Lead safe, you got to add some little bit. Next.
One person made reference to vermiculite being used, thinking that we had suggested that it could be used for dense pack. My understanding is vermiculite would never work for dense pack, and that obviously there are past concerns that if you have it, it could have asbestos. Is that correct?
Yeah, vermiculite is a pouring insulation. I've blown it out of walls. It's like 2 hours per inch, and there's a, my understanding of what EPA recommends is not to test it, and because the, you sample a spot here and something 8 inches away might be different and contaminated. There are people that are dead from the asbestos exposure from Libby. We have that source of vermiculite in our area, and I've been exposed to it, and it's not insulation. You know, it's soil conditioner. It's 2 hours per inch. If you're pouring it in cement blocks, you know, get some styrofoam beads, or how about buy a sheet of styrofoam? That's a, somebody likes vermiculite.
Well, be Can't careful if you've already got it in place.
Don't disturb it, right?
Okay.
Don't disturb it. Or do it under containment. Yeah.
I don't think that we really address the issue of gutting versus dense pack. You mentioned that by all means, when you can do an air barrier, you should do one. But in many cases, we're seeing the assumption that a house should be gutted because you'll get a better insulation job if you gut it than if you dense packed it. Could you comment on that?
Yeah. We're learning more about vapor barriers.
You mean air barriers?
Both, but the vapor barrier part. I think the placement of a vapor impermeable, air impermeable membrane over the outside sheathing, but under the exterior foam is just fine. And that's really, you can actually do it. And you don't have to take the cavity apart. So, unless you want to take it out, you know, if you, my picture is that what we do today, if we cut 60% of the heat loss in this area compared to what we'll get with the full package, and they're not doing the super insulation or the exterior wrap, you know, the additional R10 or 20, they're not doing that for a few years. You know, it's fine. It's great. We paid for it. You know, the pictures, the second photograph we started with on Monday, was 500 gallons a year starting in 1976. Now, if we leave his walls empty because we might put styrofoam on them, 500 gallons times how many years is how much oil? For what purpose? You know, you can do the, if the air barrier is in the middle, if the vapor barrier is in the middle, it's not the end of the world. It's, again, what the ICC has done, and Joe Stiebrick was responsible for this in the residential code, is they've made a chart where if you have, they're using it for a roof, but if you have in Minnesota R25 or R30 of closed cell or air impermeable foam outboard and outboard of the vapor barrier or the membrane, then you can put, you know, the R20 or 30 inside, and there's no problem. It's just the air never sees a dew point. And there's research going on about what actually happens with air, with moisture transport from the exterior under summertime drive with reservoir claddings like brick and stucco. But No, put it on the outside where you can see it. And that's how, you know, if it's a steel stud, maybe you don't bother because the steel is so bad, it conducts so much energy that if it's on its own, it's, it cuts it in half or better. I'm talking too much.
Well, we're out of time, Jim. So what we'll do is if you can answer a few of the questions we got that were more specific, we'll post those. So folks should check back to the news and events homepage of the Thousand Ohm Challenge website. We'll also be sending out a link to folks to remind them of when the sessions are posted.
Yeah, Linda, send me those questions. I'll do those now.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Jim. I want to thank PG&E's Energy Training Center for hosting this series and thank your participation for being on and asking so many questions. And we look forward from hearing you, and we'll keep you in tune as to future sessions that will be offered starting in probably January, February, or February, March. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Thank you all.